Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. On the occasion of the exhibition Tintoretto, Artist of Renaissance Venice, Eric Denker, Senior Lecturer at the National Gallery of Art, presents a four-part lecture series examining Jacopo Tintoretto's work in the context of 16th century Venetian art, history, and culture. In this second lecture, Becoming Tintoretto, the Early Work, held on April 23, 2019, Denker investigates Tintoretto's formative years as an artist. According to early biographers, Tintoretto only briefly studied with the eminent painter Titian early in his career. The ambitious young son of a cloth dyer drew his inspiration from both the older master's works and from a variety of younger, more experimental artists during his formative years. Tintoretto's work was informed both by the example of Pordenone as a kind of anti-Titian mannerist and by the experimentation of younger collaborators, including Andrea Schiavone and Bonifazio de Pittati. By the time Tintoretto was 30, his own painting had reached a new level of sophistication and confidence, as seen in St. Mark and the Miracle of the Slave, which he painted for the Scuola Grande di San Marco in 1548.
Welcome to the West Building Lecture Hall. I'm Eric Denker with the staff of the Education Division, and today we have the second in the series of lectures that provide context for the exhibition of Jacopo Tintoretto, Artist of Renaissance Venice. I talked about how Titian dominated the first half of the century based on his ideas that derived from Bellini and then from Giorgione, and how he had great rivals, including Pordenone and others. And I showed you some examples, and I will come back to some of those examples today. What we're here to investigate is how Tintoretto, self-taught largely, moves from this kind of furniture decoration, this image, probably of Esther and Ahasuerus, done about the time he's perhaps 20, 21, 22, this small-scale wood panel, and how he moves from this through a series of encounters and engagements with other art and artists, and how he gets to this, the painting that announces the confidence, the fully formed artist that will then become the dominating artist of the second half of the century. This, the Miracle of the Slave and San Marco. And so we will be building toward this image as we go through. The exhibition opens with this painting, and this is a painting that shows Tintoretto at about the age of 30. And we date Tintoretto and his birth back to 1518, 1519, and we know that he's of humble origins, that he comes out of the artisan class, that his father, Battista Robusti, is a dyer of cloth, as you can see in this woodcut illustration, and that he enters, according to the early biographers, Ridolfi and others, he enters perhaps into Titian's studio briefly. And that Titian, who isn't a very dedicated teacher, doesn't get along with his pupil. And it's been suggested that he is, at that moment, something of a wise guy, that he has a temperament that is very different from Titian's. And we will see that in some of the work as well. And so being largely self-taught, how do you go about progressing? You're an ambitious young artist. You're feeling your oats. How do you look for and obtain commissions that will bring you into an important place? So we know he's a sponge. He's absorbing from every conceivable possibility, from every conceivable source, and trying to reconcile those together. And so one of the things we find is, in fact, early on, if you look at the upper image here, and I've just shown it to you, that this is a panel that was meant to be applied to a piece of furniture, essentially to a large box. And that the makers of these images for furniture were under the arcades in Piazza San Marco. And this kind of painting demanded certain elements. And the first of those elements is that it needed speed. And the second was that it needed bright color to play off against the neutral brown wood color of the background. And so these are two attributes that he will pick up on early on. So that's one source that we can go to. A second source has to do with him working inexpensively for people who own palaces, either on the Grand Canal or on the great squares of Venice, who, while their buildings were being constructed or shortly after, chose to have them decorated with frescoes. Fresco, plaster, applied wet, painted so that it absorbs that color and becomes part of the fabric of the facade. And yet in Venice, these don't last very long. The salt sea air wears them away very quickly. They're enormously ephemeral in this sense. We know, by way of early biographers, that Tintoretto did at least 8 of these frescoes. And generally speaking, he did them for the cost of the materials because they would bring him publicity. It was a way of advertising his talent. And we know that some of them were on the Grand Canal and some of them were on squares, the Palazzo Gussone in Santo Stefano. There were frescoes that were in Campo San Polo. And we know that there were frescoes on the facade of the Palazzo Soranzo dell'Angelo. This is very close to St. Mark. It's a nice prominent location. You walk over two bridges where you see this facade all the time. Now, we know that these were away. In some cases, even in the 18th century, while they were wearing away, we had engravers who transcribed what still could be seen. And we know that he was experimenting, he was thinking. And so the two prints that you see down below are by Anton Maria Zanetti, and they are etchings that were made after frescoes that were on Casa Soranzo dell'Angelo. What do they represent? They show us that Tintoretto is interested in figures that are breaking the illusionistic space. You can see that over here with this figure coming off of this pedestal as if about to leap into our space. And we know that he worked alongside Andrea Schiavone, who used this kind of illusionism. And that specifically at Palazzo Soranzo, Casa Soranzo, he also had this fantasy element here with hands and feet that seemed to be holding up the entablature at the top of the palace. And you can see that Tintoretto is given credit here. These were a series of etchings that captured some of those frescoes that were being lost. So we know this is another way of getting your name out there, another way of advertising your availability. And copying. So this is actually a copy of one of Carpaccio's images for the Scuola Sant'Orsola and the martyrdom of the 10,000. And you try and hook up with other painters who need studio assistants, who recognize that you can be helpful to them. And one of these artists is undoubtedly Bonifacio di Pitate, sometimes called Bonifacio Veronese. And Bonifacio was much older, born in 1487. He probably trained under Palma Vecchio, who was one of the rivals of Titian that we mentioned last week. And we know that he is working in Venice in the 1520s and 1530s. And although we have no documentation, we believe that, in fact, that Tintoretto works with him to some degree. Now, this is an altarpiece by Bonifacio. It is an image that was painted for a small scuola, a confraternity, for the tailors' confraternity, and this is the Madonna of the tailors. It is a work that today is in the Academia, and it shows the patron saint of tailors over there to the left, Saint Omobono. He's here, and we identify him by these large shears that are down over here. So this is a Sacra Conversazione. It is the Madonna and Child surrounded by saints, Saint Barbara over here, and the saint of the tailors over on this side. And he is also giving charity, and it is this figure that interests us in particular, because that figure is squeezed into the scene, and the distortions in the anatomy and the foreshortening suggest that Bonifacio was familiar with mannerist imagery from central Italy at this time as well. There's something else we should note here, since this is from 1533, and it's the kind of painting that Tintoretto would have seen. And that is, it's a sacred conversation, but the figures are not set back into a clearly defined space. They are pushed forward. And while we can see that step in the foreground and the two steps leading up to the throne that the Madonna and Child are on, we don't get a full sense of the architecture. Instead, the figures dominate. And the young Tintoretto understands that the figures are the most expressive vehicle in art right away. And so, upstairs, there is really only a room and a half, that is devoted to the youthful Tintoretto, what we might call his juvenile years. This is the key painting in the first room, and it is done in 1540. It is dated, so he's about 22 years old when this is done, and it's simply signed Jacobus, so that perhaps he hadn't yet started to use the diminutive Tintoretto at this point. He's still thinking in terms of being Jacopo Robusti. It is a painting that's also a Sacra Conversazione. And you can see two things evident here. The first is that he clearly understands this idea of moving the figures up toward the fictive margin between the illusionistic space in the painting and our own space. So they're close to us. And the setting isn't particularly important in terms of artistic expression. He pays lip service to a little bit of landscape, a tree, a couple of clouds. So that's the first thing that perhaps he's learning from Bonifacio and maybe Andrea Schiavone. But there's a second thing here that's important to acknowledge, and that is that normally in this kind of altarpiece, all the figures would be static. And here they're not. Not St. Francis over on the right, not St. Catherine, not the figures of probably St. James back there and St. Zachariah over here on this side. Not even the Madonna, who is perched on the edge of a bench, holding with one hand as if seeking balance and balancing the child with one hand, which gives this a sense, an improbable sense, in terms of imbalance. It isn't carefully weighted. We don't have that sense of the figures and gravity holding them in place. There are other things that we should mention in terms of this painting. His indebtedness, so that we know that the Madonna, not leaning back, or perhaps not with the child Jesus flying off in the direction of St. Francis, But we know that her pose is derived from Michelangelo's Medici Madonna, recently created for the Medici tombs in Florence. And we know that he has access to small-scale models, perhaps wax, perhaps clay, perhaps a kind of plaster, that have been brought. And we know that several artists, including Bonifacio and Schiavone and others, have done drawings after Michelangelo's work, and those would have been brought to Venice as well. I want you to notice, in particular, St. Francis and the Madonna and the face of the Madonna. And here you'll recognize the cross-legged position of the Michelangelo. You'll recognize in Bonifacio's work, St. Francis, who is lifted wholesale and then brought back. And also, you'll notice the face of this Salviati, Madonna and Child, now in Bologna, but painted in Venice, and the face of the Madonna really very closely approximated. And here with Salviati, we have large-scale figures. We have a little bit of ambiguity of space, of expression, and that we'll get some of these elements as well. And again, Salviati has made studies after Michelangelo. So we see all of these types of elements that are being grafted on to his ideas. And we can see that when we look at other paintings by Bonifacio. This one now in Venice in the Ca' Razonico in the Mestrovich collection, this Madonna and Child with saints. And again, the large scale, the lack of a unity of space behind them, the clarity with which they're drawn, but the very tight space that these figures inhabit. It is, I think, Bonifacio that we have to acknowledge as being very important in this regard. And yet, there is reason to think that some of this influence goes back and forth. Because this is an image by Bonifacio of Christ among the doctors. And it is normally dated to 1544-45. It is today in the Palazzo Pitti collection in Florence. It is a scene of Christ among the doctors. And it is a radical reorganization of space that we come to expect in Mannerist work, in work that distorts emotion, color, scale, space for artistic purposes. So here's Christ back here in this enormous room, and he seems much smaller and less important than the large-scale figures that you see here who are onlookers in the temple. And we have this plunging perspective that takes us back this way and the steps, which brings us back to Christ and the doctors here, but then we have small-scale figures here, and we have no understanding of what's going on in the architecture back here. It is somewhat ironic that this great painting by the young Tintoretto is usually dated slightly earlier. It's generally dated by scholars to 1540-41. But it's the same subject. It's Christ among the doctors. And it is a painting that is in the Duomo, in the Cathedral of Milan. So what are we looking at? We're looking past these large figures here, the doctors of the church, these figures of prominent authorities. And here is Christ. And again, the perspective leads us back. So the main subject is buried in the mid and background. Is it possible that he learned this from Bonifacio, or is it possible that Bonifacio picked up on this from the young Tintoretto? And this is made difficult by the fact that so few of these paintings are dated and so few are documented as to the moment in which they were done. What we can say is that not only is this a radical reorganization of pictorial space, but that these large-scale figures are clearly based on Raphael and Michelangelo. And it is good to remind ourselves that while there were no Michelangelo sculpture paintings in Venice at this moment, there was a great Raphael, the cartoon for one of the tapestries that had been done for the Vatican, had been acquired by the Grimani family, who had strong Roman ties, and in their palace near Santa Maria Formosa, it could be seen. And this is a place where Bonifacio would work and others would work at this moment. To see the distance at this moment between Titian and Tintoretto is to compare this painting. And the last painting and this painting were both prominent in the exhibition that took place simultaneously with the exhibition in the Doge's Palace, largely seen upstairs, over in the Accademia. And it was a revelation to see the early Tintoretto among the works of contemporaries. So this painting is there, was there in this show. And the painting that you see here is Titian's Supper at Emmaus, painting now in the Louvre, done around 1530. Look at the balance in the composition. Look at the way in which the figures have graceful poses, gestures. Look at the detail, this kind of very careful, spacious idea of perspective, and look at the detail of the magnificent tablecloth and the items that are here just before the moment that Christ reveals himself to be the resurrected Christ. Well, look at the balance and harmony here and the expressions here, and compare it to this work by Tintoretto of the same subject from about a decade later, 1542-43, now in Budapest. How does Tintoretto interpret this same subject? Instead of that calm and that harmony, everything is in movement, everything is in motion, and emotion becomes more important. Here is Christ as he reveals himself. And he tries to imagine, Tintoretto tries to imagine what it would be like to be here and look at this figure who turns away questioningly. Do you believe this? Are we to take this as truth? Or the others, and they're moving in a variety of different directions, and their attitudes take us away from Christ rather than concentrating on that sharp geometric element right in the center. Another potent influence, an artist who's working in Venice, who is a great rival of Titian, comes on the scene after 1527, and his name is Pordenone, named after the town in Friuli that he comes from. His actual name, Giovanni Antonio di Sacchis, never used. We talk about Pordenone, and Pordenone brings certain ideas to Venice, and we can see them in this painting and the next painting. So these are paintings that are done in the late 20s and early 30s by an artist who comes out of the orbit of Titian and out of the orbit of Palma Vecchio, but who also has a high regard for central Italian art and what's going on with the followers of Michelangelo, with Giulio Romano and others. So these figures are more monumental, more aggressive in their musculature, more aggressive in their sense of movement. And the two figures here are St. Martin on the left and St. Christopher on the right. These were doors, cabinet doors, that were in the church of San Rocco, where sacred objects were kept high above the floor level. And so they are over life size, they're monumental. And that's given added weight by the fact that they're tightly enclosed in very limited spaces. These were taken down and cleaned in anticipation of the exhibitions. Today, rather than being high on the wall, they are on the floor of the Church of San Rocco, where you can walk right up to them and examine them very, very closely and see the kind of monumentality that Pordenone intended. And this was, I think, a challenge to Titian, whose figures tended to be human scale and more harmoniously disposed. And what are we to make of this? And again, I showed this last week, but it's more relevant here in the course of this discussion. Here, this is an altarpiece for the Church of San Giovanni il Leminosario. It is a small church near the Rialto Markets. And it's an altarpiece off to the right. It's not on the high altarpiece, but off to the right as you go into the central part of the church. And it shows Saint Sebastian, Saint Catherine, and San Rocco. It would have been, I think, astounding and in many ways appalling to the viewers of the time. First of all, they were used to a much more balanced image of saints. They were used to a sense of spaciousness, of three-dimensionality, of poise. Instead, these three figures have been squeezed into a very small fictive space. And in order to accommodate Saint Sebastian, he has to lean back this very odd pose. And he is in profile perdu. We don't see his face. And he is next to Saint Catherine. We recognize the wheel. And look at her expression. And we think of Pontormo and Rosso Fiorentino and the masters of the maniera, of this distortion in the art of central Italy. And then, not knowing quite where she must be standing, we look down here and we see an angel as San Rocco shows the bubo, the plague sore, on his leg. All of them squeezed into this odd shape with no sense of space, with no sense of a kind of coherent composition. It is at this moment that the young Tintoretto ambitiously looks for a commission to do a ceiling for an important family in Venice, the Pisani family. And they have a palace near San Paternian, near what is today Campo San Paternio, but usually called today Campo Manin, the little square that's not, again, far from the Rialto, but on the San Marco side. And he, Vittore Pisani, commissions Tintoretto to do 16 paintings for his ceiling. And they are of Ovidian tales, tales from Ovid's Metamorphosis, in one form or another. And they have to do with the ideas of classical mythology, of classical literature. And we have brought these two here. And they are images that we recognize, and we also appreciate that Tintoretto has taken a particular approach. So the first thing is, these are meant to be on the ceiling. And Tintoretto always takes location into account. And so these are on the ceiling, and so he does them in a perspective which we call di sotto in su, as if we're looking up through these openings and seeing the figures above us as we look from below. The figures themselves are muscular figures fitted into tight spaces. It goes with what we've just been talking about with Pordenone, to a lesser extent with Bonifacio. As you look, the scene that is here on the left is a scene that is of the judgment of Midas, who is here, who is judging the contest between Apollo and Marsyas. And the story goes, right after the story of Midas and the Golden Touch, the story goes that Marsyas, a satyr, is bragging, trying to impress a group of beautiful young woodland nymphs, and bragging about how beautiful his music is, and that it's even more beautiful than the god Apollo's. Now, this is classical literature. This kind of lack of humility is always punished by the gods. And so Apollo challenges him to a contest, And Apollo plays the viola da braccio, that's what's in his hand over here, while normally we see Marsyas playing the pan flute, in this particular case simply a wind instrument. And of course, as a result, Apollo wins. And the punishment for this lack of humility is that Marsyas will be flayed, skinned alive. And in the abstract, this is horrible enough. But in fact, much of the century, the Venetians and Europeans were at war with the Turks, who in fact engaged at certain times in flaying contemporary enemies. And so it would have had an added resonance for them. The scene on the right is the fall of Phaeton. It is the son of Apollo who begs his father until finally his father can no longer withhold the favor of letting Phaeton drive the chariot of the sun across the skies. But the youthful Phaeton has no control over the horses, and so he veers out into space, and Earth gets very cold, and then he veers back toward the Earth, and Earth gets too hot and catches on fire. And finally, the king of the gods has had enough, and he throws down thunderbolts and knocks Phaeton and the carriage out of the sky, allegedly in the Po Valley in northern Italy. So it had contemporary resonance. It's shown here, and these are difficult poses, both human poses and the poses for the horses, as they're knocked out of the sky. And we see the wheel of the chariot, and we see Phaeton plunging down, unable to control. There are up here the reins, unable to control the chariot of the sun. This had been a famous story that had been illustrated by Michelangelo. And there were drawings for it, the one over here from Windsor Castle. It's one variation, the one over here. Michelangelo, doing very finished drawings, has in mind the idea of the dramatic denouement of this story, of the horses and the chariot and Phaeton plunging down. And while we don't have a one-to-one connection here, it is certainly Michelangelesque of Tintoretto to have essayed this story. He wouldn't have needed to know the drawings themselves. All he would have needed to know was the Niccolò Beatrice engraving after the Michelangelo. And so this reproduces that. And prints are an essential source of influence on Tintoretto. And we can see that here in this image after Michelangelo of the archers attacking this Herm. And look at the musculature. And it's clear to us that the young Tintoretto idolizes Michelangelo's manipulation of the human body and his variety of poses and variety of angles to capture those poses. There are still in existence 14 of these works. They are in the Galleria Estense in Modena, and we have two on loan, but there are others. And again, you have to imagine, these were up on the ceiling, and here we have Apollo and Daphne catches up to her just as she begins to turn into a tree, and we have this view from below and these rather difficult bodies to convey in the sense of their twists and turns and of their musculature, and other images from this same series. Part of the inspiration here is almost undoubtedly from somebody who had worked alongside Michelangelo, who sometimes collaborated with him, and that is Giulio Romano. Now, unlike Titian, Tintoretto was not a great traveler. He didn't journey far afield looking for commissions. But early on, it appears that he did go to Mantova, and he knew of the art that had been done in Mantova, including this work by Giulio Romano, in the Palazzo Te, sometimes referred to as the Palazzo del Te, in Mantova. And this is the Room of the Giants. And you can see the enormous figures, the illusionism of the architecture, and of the gods in the clouds up above. So in terms of musculature, in terms of this radical reorganization of space, and in terms of difficult bodies in proportion, all of this would have had an effect on him too. This wasn't simply in secular subjects. It could be in images that derive from religious subjects as well. And so this is a painting. It is today in Venice in the collection of the Quirini Stampalia Gallery. And it is by Andrea Schiavone. And as you look at it, what's the subject? Done in the 1540s, it is an image of the conversion of Saul. And this is of that New Testament narrative. Saul off to be allowed to arrest Christians, knocked from his horse, blinded. God up in the heavens speaking down to him, "Why do you pursue me?" And the miraculous conversion of Paul. And it's a very important story, New Testament narrative. And here it's done by Schiavone. And there's God merging from the clouds with a few figures, angels near him. And there is Saul having been knocked off his horse. And this dark area that provides a contrast with the illumination of God above and the light that plays off of Saul below. Well, it is precisely this kind of painting that would help to inspire the work that's upstairs from the National Gallery's own collection. And that is Our Conversion of Paul, which dates to about the same time and is by Tintoretto. And there's God up there, and there's Saul down here, and there are horses rearing up in amazement as this horse slides down these steps, a moment of very brilliant invention on the part of Tintoretto, and then the bridge over here and the horse that's rearing up over here. So, does this simply derive from the Schiavone? In fact, no, because we know from this drawing, which is a copy of Titian's Battle of Cadore, which was on the wall of the Great Council in the Doge's Palace before the fire, that in fact, Tintoretto is quoting here the horse on the bridge that would be seen in the background. And we can see it here, or we can see it here in this contemporary copy, anonymous copy, that shows some of this same element, and then figures down here in the place of Saul. All of these, in the end, derive from the Michelangelo that was done for the Pauline chapels in the Vatican, the conversion of Saul here, which was begun in 1542, completed in 1545. And there is God, and notice how he swings into our space, foreshortened, it's a difficult pose, and how light comes down and blinds Saul, who is prone here on the ground. And I want you to notice these strong, muscular, monumental figures, whether they're in the heavens or down here on earth. And these are the kinds of things that affected a whole series of artists, not just Tintoretto. And so we can see that in the work of Schiavone and of others at this moment. And then a more direct connection to Michelangelo comes to Venice in the person of Giorgio Vasari, friend of Michelangelo, the biographer of Michelangelo later on, who understands and exalts in the work of Michelangelo. And so we know that Vasari does a series of decorations for the upper walls of palaces, and we know that Tintoretto looks at those and creates his own. And this is from a series of four. This is the one that we own here at the National Gallery. They were all octagonal originally. This is summer, and we know that by the wheat, by the birds, by the growth in the trees, by the birds over here. A robust, muscular figure, larger than life. We have it adjacent to the one that's in the Norfolk Museum, which is of spring. And spring is meant to be understood by way of the flowers, but also by way of this unusual position, which is meant to suggest the fertility and fecundity of spring as well. And one is lost, Winter, probably an old man. This one's in a private collection, it's Autumn. And again, it's a difficult figure, disposed in a difficult pose with a certain amount of foreshortening, the twisting of the body. And we know that he's looking at these Vasaris. And these two works by Vasaris are allegories. The one on top is an allegory of faith. The one on the below is the allegory of patience. They were done in 1541. And although they're in the Academia today, they were for a private palace. The figures that you see here, their faces and hair, their dramatic poses, in the case here, when we looked back at Autumn, are all inspirational in the work of the young Tintoretto. Tintoretto cultivated important figures for his career. They could be great patrons, members of the church, government officials. They could be leading members of important confraternities of the Scuole. One of the figures who he comes into contact with of great importance to us is Pietro Aretino. Aretino had come to Venice after the sack of Rome in 1527, and we know that he became the leading critic in the arts, that he published letters regularly. Those letters were often to the detriment of important figures politically, important ruling families. He could make or break their reputation. He was known as the scourge of princes. And he was one of a triumvirate, along with Titian and Sansovino, who had come up after the sack of Rome and became a kind of ruling elite within the arts. We know that Tintoretto makes contact with him. And by 1544-45, we know that Tintoretto does two paintings for the ceiling of his palace on the corner near the Grand Canal. The 19th century had great fun doing depictions of artists, of Raphael, of Michelangelo, and of others. In this case, this is an artist whose name is Alexander Fragonard, and it shows Aretino in the studio of Tintoretto. It's in a private collection in New York. It was done around 1840. It goes back to a tale told by some of Tintoretto's biographers that after Aretino had written in a rather pejorative way about Tintoretto, Tintoretto has him come to the studio to do a portrait. And he appears to threaten him with the dagger, but it's not actually the case. He's simply helping him in terms of his costume. But the story had traction, and you see it depicted a number of different times. What we do know, we don't have Tintoretto's portrait of Aretino, but we have Titian's of about this moment, and it shows us this very strong countenance, this large-scale figure, this dominating presence. And what is it that Aretino commissions? He commissions two paintings. They're also based on Ovid. And here is the one that remains to us from 1544-45. It too is Apollo and Marsyas of this great contest. And there are other figures over here to the right. And perhaps this is meant to be Aretino. It's hard for us to tell. As you look at it, however, it is done, perhaps inspired by the Palazzo Pisani works, but it is done in a totally different manner. It's done as a quadro riportato, as a painting as if it's been transported and simply stuck to the ceiling. And so it doesn't have that same perspective. It is a story that we're familiar with, and we know that Aretino praised these pictures in a letter that he wrote in 15, 1945, a letter that he wrote and also wrote to Tintoretto, and I'll quote from that letter. "All connoisseurs agree that the two fables you painted are beautiful, lively, and effortless, as are the poses adopted by the figures therein. These you, so young, have painted to my great satisfaction and indeed to everyone else's, for the ceiling of my house, in less time than might have normally been devoted to the mere consideration of the subject. Speed, prestezza. This is a hallmark of the early work of Tintoretto, and that speed will continue throughout his career." It is at this point, and only after 45 minutes, that we get to the second room of the exhibition. These are the early paintings. And this is one of those early paintings. It is from about 1545, 46. Today it is in the Alte Pinakotheca in Munich. And it's a painting that suggests a lot about Tintoretto's mind and ambition at this point, because it is a classical subject. It is Vulcan and Venus and Mars. And Vulcan and Venus are partners. But Venus, the goddess of love, is having an amorous affair, tryst, with Mars. And so Vulcan, having arrived home early, comes in, and Mars hides under the bed over here. And he tries very hard to keep this little yappy dog from giving away the game, while Vulcan, entirely concentrating on if there is evidence of his wife's infidelity by looking at her thighs. And what we have here is something that I think is very important for us, and that is a very Titian-esque nude, a nude that clearly represents the kind of ambitious poesia, lyrical images of Venus and of nudes that Titian is doing at this time. In some cases, for rulers in other parts of Italy or even around Europe. So we have this very Titian-esque figure, and then we have a number of other notations here. This was for the Duke of Urbino. It is an image, it's not called a Venus for two centuries after. It is probably the mistress of the Duke of Urbino, but we're not entirely sure. It is clearly based on the work of Giorgione that had been done years earlier and perhaps completed by Titian, of his sleeping Venus, this beautiful nude in a pastoral landscape. This is the work of the Danae, which would have been almost contemporary with the Tintoretto. But what a difference. These show a kind of classical poise, an idealization, a sensibility that is far more rarefied than what Tintoretto is attempting at this moment. So we have to go back and look at this, because it's a bawdy tale told in an earthy way. And it is the young Tintoretto showing off that he can do a Titian-esque model here, but also that he can make reference here to Michelangelo's figure, this little Cupid-like figure, and that he can engage in a kind of discrimination between the heavy impasto of this paint and the much thinner paint, which is used to create the draperies here and here, and the floor as well. And that he can oppose that to the delicacy of this vase in front of this bottle-bottom glass window and its reflection, which is almost undoubtedly a reference to Dürer's Saint Jerome in his study. And Dürer had been an important influence on Venetian art as well. And then the mirror, which engages in the discussion of the paragone, the relative merits of sculpture versus painting. Sculptors who claimed that you could not only see a piece of sculpture from one angle, but that you could walk around it, and that made it superior to painting. So painters show a lot of reflections at this moment. So we see Vulcan from behind as well as in front. And we can see that in the detail here. And it's interesting to us because we understand also early on that Tintoretto will still do some compositional drawings in the Tuscan manner, in the central Italian manner. So this is the compositional drawing for that painting. And I say it's the compositional drawing because it has to do with Tintoretto working out the poses of those two main figures as the most expressive part of the painting and what will define the rest of the space. So he's interested here in Venus, but if you look closely, it's probably a man posed in that way. And then a Vulcan, and he's not interested in Mars, he's not interested in the dog, he's not interested in the vase or the details of the windows. He is going to be interested in the mirror, and so he composes the space around the figures. And there is that reference to Michelangelo. And now we go back, and I've kept it toward the end, for the idea that the early biographers and contemporaries said that he combined the drawing of Michelangelo, the disegno of Michelangelo, and the colorito, the handling of paint of Titian. And the story goes that this is what's written on the wall of his studio. And here we can see in this painting him combining aspects of these two great masters, the two dominating masters in many ways of the century. So when we look at something such as this, the Christ and the Adulteress, done around 1547, he's still not quite 30 years old, today in Dresden, we take a look at this and we see those large-scale figures well rendered, and they inhabit a space. So he is increasingly comfortable with that space. And then here, you'll think back of that figure that we saw earlier of the work of Bonifacio, of the tailor giving alms to the poor, and also of this figure. And these figures, as well as this figure, are also mentions, references, if you will, to Michelangelo. And so this is very much like the Cumaean Sibyl. And this is very much drawn from a kind of Raphaelesque source. And so we come to this pivotal painting, done when he is just around 30 years old. It is his announcement, a kind of coming out of his confidence in presenting a painting that is fully conceived, composed, beautifully drawn, and beautifully designed. It is St. Mark and the Miracle of the Slave. And it comes down as one of the tales told, the miracles that St. Mark actually creates after, long after his death. And the story goes that there is a slave or a servant, depending on the story, and he's down here, and he is from Provençal, and he decides to make a pilgrimage to the Basilica of San Marco in Venice and to pay homage to the bones of the saint, of St. Mark. And he dedicates his entire body to St. Mark. And when he returns to his master is furious. Here's his master over here. And his master decides to have him tortured and put to death. And so first, he attempts to have his eyes put out. And the torturer that you see here has the instruments, but every time he goes to move toward the slave who is prone here on the floor, St. Mark intervenes. And this is St. Mark. And remember that figure that we saw in the Michelangelo before and of other figures swooping down into our space. But not swooping from the background, but swooping from above us over here, so that his position is analogous to the position of the slave down here. And then the second torturer, who is meant to break his legs, and his instruments of torture miraculously are broken. And then the third, who is supposed to hammer his mouth so that he can't speak, and his instruments are miraculously broken. And so we see the three torturers, and they turn toward the figure here, the the master, and demonstrate the power of St. Mark, who then understands the power and decides to make his own pilgrimage and make penance to the body of St. Mark in Venice. It is incredibly carefully orchestrated. So we have a sense of the crowd moving in this direction. We have a sense of these figures moving in this direction. We have a sense of St. Mark coming in at this angle and of the slave coming in. And this is of a type of foreshortening that was greatly admired, which in fact Titian was not expert in. And then there is just this one line, this one orthogonal that really would take us back into space. And the vanishing point in the painting is the hand of St. Mark as it creates this series of miraculous occurrences. The figure that you see here is a wonderful figure. She leans back, holding a baby. She leans back so that she can see what's going on. Others bear witness from here on the column or down here. And these are quotations from Michelangelo in the Medici Chapel. And only when you actually get in front of this painting do you see the marvelous variety of colors and textures. So that this is chainmail. And only recently have we been able to look at it and see the detail and hear the red of these figures and the blue here. So we have this kind of box construction where everything is coming together right there in the center. It was done for the Scuola Grande di San Marco, one of the great charitable confraternities. It was to be between two windows on the short wall at the opposite end from the altar. The principal windows were over here. And so Tintoretto, as a good Renaissance artist, takes that into account, that the light comes from this side, and it is consistent, except the glow that emanates from St. Mark as he comes down. And the richness of this color is picked up in this color, and down through here. It is heavily painted. It is a demonstration piece where he showed that he is the equal of any artist working in Venice. And what's important here is Titian is not in Venice at the moment. He'd gone abroad to work. There was some question about whether or not he would ever come back. And we know that Aretino certainly has this in mind, and he writes about this painting. He singles out this depiction of the slave in particular, and he notes the three-dimensionality of this figure as a signal accomplishment, obvious to both expert and untutored eyes. There is no man so little instructed, he writes, in the virtue of disegno, that he would not marvel at the relief of the figure who, quite naked on the ground, lies open to the cruelties of his martyrdom. This quality of disegno was something that Aretino rarely mentioned when commending the paintings of Titian for their handling and colorito. Now, the brothers didn't immediately warm to the painting. Perhaps for political reasons as much as artistic reasons. And because they disagreed, Tintoretto took the painting back for a while and he took it back to his studio. But they finally came to an agreement and it became this centerpiece in a public place, in a scuola, where other people could come and see it. Now, it's not that the subject is entirely new. We know that Sansovino had done this bronze plaque for the left choir stall up on the altar at San Marco. It tells the same story, the miracles of St. Mark. There are a series of these. So here is that figure, and here is Sansovino being a good architect, gives us a nice sense of that space. But look how crowded it is, and look how it's difficult to make out actually what's going on. In the Tintoretto, the scene unfolds, the narrative unfolds for us in a very clear way. As spectators, we are witness to these events. This reorganization of space that he so often indulges in can be seen in a work that he did for San Marcuola that's now in Madrid. It is this image from just after, perhaps 1548-49, Christ washing the feet of the disciples. And I want you to notice here that he's understood some of that spatial perspective, the great architecture, the recession, the lines of recession. But he's done something very interesting here. The main subject is squeezed in all the way over here to the right, Christ washing the feet of the apostles. All of this is episodic narrative. The apostle taking off his shoes. This one having his pants stripped off there in the middle ground. The dog, and these anecdotal areas command our attention in many ways more than this. But the scale suggests the familiarity with Sebastiano Serlio and Vitruvio and the idea of pictorial space rendered in this way. And here are a couple of those details. And I want you to notice this figure in particular helping the man with his pants, because it's a riff on Michelangelo's Battle of Cascina and the way in which pants are being taken off. And we're reminded of the variety of different poses, the variety of different approaches to those poses, front, back, side, foreshortened, which Michelangelo had begun, never finished, in the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence. Surviving are drawings and some paintings, such as this one by San Gallo, now in Holkham Hall in England. It is that kind of anatomical exploration of figures in a variety of different poses, foreshortened, seen from different angles, that show up in this, the altarpiece that was done for a church in Vicenza celebrating Sant'Agostino up here. And look at the foreshortening of this figure and the difficult pose that he sets himself to do, clearly rivaling Michelangelo for the expressiveness of the human body. Well, he would go on very shortly to do these laterali, these side paintings for the high altar in San Rocco, where he has to create the illusionistic space. He creates these very foreshortened figures here in San Rocco, healing plague victims in the church of San Rocco. And in many ways, this will be a kind of tryout for the paintings that he hopes to obtain in 1564 in the Scuola. Now, this is a painting which is meant to be viewed not head on, the way we're looking at it, but from over here. Because again, this would be sacred space right here. So the viewer would be over here. So you'd be looking past these larger figures. And so the vanishing point comes in at an odd angle, or from this point, the position of the priest as well. It is opposite this painting of San Rocco in prison. And look now, the familiar figure plunging in, swooping in from space off stage, and then the central figures and the opportunity to create a variety of different expressive elements to the human body. And these will eventually lead to the great series of paintings that are in the Scuola Grande di San Rocco, including the crucifixion, including the scenes from the Passion of Christ, Old and New Testament scenes, as well as the life of Mary. And that will be the subject of the third of our lectures, will be about Tintoretto at the Scuola San Rocco, and then finally Tintoretto around the rest of Venice. Thanks so much for your attendance.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.